Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down, Griffiths.
Stick in your eyes!
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day and welcome to Democracy Sausage, coming to you from the ANU. And I'm Mark Kenny, of course, from the School of Politics and International Relations and the Australian Studies Institute. And, of course, the election's on and there are gaffes already. We've seen mistakes from both sides, but particularly from the Leader of the Opposition, Anthony Albanese, in relation to the cash rate and in relation to the unemployment rate. This has been jumped on by the media and... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are very mixed feelings about this out there. Many people are saying on talkback lines, on texts, on social media, that they think this is appalling superficiality by the media, and that it really doesn't reflect well on the nature of the debate. I guess to some extent, I'd say 'twas ever thus. That is the way it is in election campaigns. They are highly theatrical and kind of symbolic in lots of ways, and not the best place to be having deep policy discussions because it gets obscured in all this nonsense, in a sense. But it has happened before, and we've seen leaders on both sides make those kinds of errors. On the plus side, nobody usually remembers what happened in week one by the time you get to about week three or four of a campaign. There's so much noise and tumult in an election campaign that, you know, it seems when you get to about that later in the campaign, what happened early on seems like it happened a year ago or so. People just forget it. Having said that, the government's not going to let voters forget it completely. They had social media ads out straight away showing Anthony Albanese not being able to say the unemployment rate at 4%. It was a bit of a surprise because of that being such a central issue of the budget, that unemployment was now down to 4%, that in fact programmed in the budget or projected in the budget to go to 3.75%, and some say even lower than that this year. So it's a central feature of the government's economic success story, it says. And given that it's running this line that Anthony Albanese is untried, untested, hasn't held an economic portfolio, their main strategy had always been to try and suggest that Anthony Albanese can't be trusted and his team can't be trusted managing this economic success story. So it was a little bit surprising that on the very first full day of campaigning, Labor fell at this hurdle, particularly on the unemployment rate. The cash rate perhaps a little less significant, partly because it's not actually the interest rate that people pay. It's the official rate set by the Reserve Bank, and it is at a record low of 10 basis points or 0.1%. Anyway, the government's seeking its fourth term. That ought to be a big issue, and there are so many concerns about the way the government has performed over those three terms, so much scar tissue that the Prime Minister himself is carrying. So perhaps the election campaign will get down to some more serious stuff as we proceed on. We'll just have to wait and see on that. With me in the studio today is Dr. Charles Miller from the School of Politics and International Relations also. He's a political scientist. He's also an expert on security and foreign and strategic policy questions. So we're going to be talking to him a bit later, mostly about Ukraine. How are you, Charles?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Yep. Great to have you back.
Thank you.
It's been a while.
Great to be back.
Yeah, there's some very very interesting things happening in your fields of expertise, so we'll certainly come to that. And we may, in fact, hear from you in this first section, because in the first section we're going to talk to Evan Eakin-Smith, who is the Australian Electoral Commission's Director of Media and Digital Engagement. Welcome to you, Evan.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's terrific to have you on. And I wanted to do this, and thank you for being available, because I wanted to do this because, you know, I've just been talking about politics, not an area that you need to go into or will be wanting to go into, but the Electoral Commission is absolutely crucial. It is the mechanics of our democratic process, and what your organisation does is deliver us these elections so Australians can exercise their democratic right and indeed obligation under our system, and the Australian Electoral Commission has a very high standing. It's not like the US where people complain that there's political interference and there's all kinds of irregularities and all kinds of inconsistencies state to state. So it's been a success story, but of course you're putting this election together. You've had plenty of time to think about the election coming up, but these are anything but normal times. So you've no doubt done a fair bit of planning, but tell us what happens now that the starter's gun has been fired. What does that mean for the AEC?
Well, to put it short, it means a really busy time. We've been planning pretty much since the Ritz return for the previous federal election in 2019. And whenever I say that, I think people balk a little bit and they say, really? Do you really need to do that? But it is one of Australia's largest peacetime logistical events. When you add COVID on top of that, overlay makes it incredibly complex. And COVID's changing rapidly still. Polling day, even though election's been announced, polling day is about 6 weeks away. What the COVID environment looks like at that time, we still don't know. So it's a massive exercise. As soon as that starter's gun went, we looked to confirm our staff. We need 105,000 staff. We become one of the nation's largest employers, albeit for a very short period of time.
Yeah, so that's not 105,000 people for the 6 weeks, but presumably it's not just on the day either.
No, it's not. So the vast majority are just on that single day where we have around 8,000 odd polling places in operation. But we have hundreds of early voting centres that will be operating from the 9th of May. We need to staff them, of course. We also have the count period after which can last, well, for the Senate, it lasts quite a long time. We will return the writs on or before the 28th of June. So it's a long process. And we've had materials managers and a range of other roles working for us in the lead up to the announcement of the election as well. So busy times at the AEC.
Yeah. Look, I'm just going to jump ahead because of something you said just toward the end of that answer then about the writs returning for the Senate on the 28th of June. That is the reason, it's just worth dwelling on that for a moment, that is the reason why the 21st of May was the last time that a half Senate election could occur, which is the normal accompaniment to a House of Reps election in our system, isn't it? That you needed that period of time in order to do that count and return those writs and therefore have those senators ready to take their place on July 1.
Yeah, that's right. We have hundreds of millions of preferences marked on Senate ballot papers, and they all need to be recorded, validated into the system before we can distribute preferences. That's not a small task. We've got human eyes on that process through the entire time, and we transport our ballot papers to central facilities. It doesn't happen in a matter of days, and probably we'll be butting right up against that deadline of the 28th of June to get Senate writs returned.
Yeah, it's a really complex process. The Senate's a different counting system from the reps, and of course, it's not where government is formed, and so we don't really hear about it on election night. It's not the critical issue on election night. It's who's got the majority in the House of Reps that will be able to form a government. But of course, it's utterly crucial thereafter in terms of how that government can enact its program or not, as the case may be. But it's it's like all the sort of busy work goes on for you, or busy work's the wrong way of putting it. All the intensity goes on for the Electoral Commission, and I guess nail biting for the parties and those senators that are sort of going up and down in what can be some very drawn out counts, very drawn out preference flows that. I think in the ACT, for example, someone told me the other day it took 39 rounds of counting for Zed Seselja to finally be elected as the second ACT senator at the last election. So that's a lot of recalculation.
Yeah, and that's the ACT Senate ballot paper, which, of course, is quite a deal smaller than
yeah,
most.
Quite simple, yeah.
Yeah, we often refer to election night as the halfway point for the AEC, and it really is. The count is a long process. It's a complicated process, not just in the activities that we're doing, of course, of counting ballot papers, but also the transport, the logistics. We've got something like 40,000 different transport routes that our ballot papers use to get back to their home electorates to join counts. So it's a significant exercise, and security is obviously front of mind when we're doing all of that.
Yeah. So let's go back to another point you made in that first answer about COVID. What are the changes you've had to bring to bear as a result of COVID, in as much as we know it to date? As you say, there could even be changes between now and polling day, but COVID's obviously changed the way we do lots of things. Is it basic things like, you know, hand sanitizer at the booth? I'm sure there are many other things you'd have to take into account.
No, it is basic things for the most part. So it is hand sanitizer and some of the simple things. Speaking of just hand sanitizer, we'll have 63,000 litres of the stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, not to mention 34,000 bottles of surface cleaner, and we'll have dedicated hygiene officers using those to wipe down not just surfaces but pencils in between use.
Are people encouraged to bring their own writing implement? Is that possible, or is it still going to be the AEC pencil approach?
Yeah, we'll encourage people, but we'll have 4.5 million pencils this time. We normally have about 100,000, and that's to make sure that people can use a clean pencil, of course. Right. And so we expect the majority of people to be using those.
And what about other measures? I mean, one of the things that's been a feature of COVID for just about every aspect of our lives has been the slowing down of processes, keeping your distance, people taking longer to do things because they're checking in and these sort of thing. Obviously, people aren't going to have to do QR check-in at the polling booth, presumably, but the South Australian election, I noticed there was some commentary on the night. I was watching the ABC coverage, and Tom Koutsantonis, one of the senior Labor people, front benchers, ministers now, was complaining that the queues were enormous at some of the polling booths, presumably because people were taking longer to go through the process. I'm not sure why that would be, but is that an issue that you need to take into account?
Absolutely, it is. Look at simple things like ordering a coffee if you've got a mask on. That can be lost in translation.
Yeah.
Not to mention, we've got a complicated interaction there.
I'm glad to hear that you're going to be offering coffee at the polling station.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it? No, democracy sausages and cupcakes only, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and that's afterwards, right?
Oh, yeah, you got to vote. Voting's the most important thing.
That's right.
Yeah, but things like masks can slow it down. You mentioned QR codes. They won't be in place unless there's a local health direction for them to be.
Yes.
We really rest on the local health restrictions for things like QR codes and whether or not voters need to wear masks. All of our staff will be wearing masks, and we've made it a condition of employment for our staff to be vaccinated as well. In terms of queues, it potentially will slow down the process. We're very fortunate in Australia not to be seeing scenes like what we see internationally where people are queuing 9 or 10 hours. That won't happen. I don't think that'd be palatable. The AEC would be in a world of strife. But you might see some decent queues at some polling places, and we ask people to be really patient with that.
And what's your message there? Is don't leave it to the last minute, I guess. You'll be wanting to say that quite a lot so that there's an even flow over the day rather than getting to the situation where you've got, 200 people outside a polling booth and it's 5 to 6 or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be running a significant campaign. Well, we already are, but we're talking about enrollment at the moment. But we're going to be running a significant campaign in advance of the voting period to encourage people to plan their vote. look at your circumstances this federal election. If you're a shift worker and you might be working on election day, for instance, if you work in a setting where you're more vulnerable to COVID, you might want to plan your vote during that early voting period to make sure that you can access it.
That question about enrollment, you say you're focusing on that in the early part of the campaign. That's obviously critically important. How many new people come onto the roll each time for an election? Do you have that figure or sort of roughly at hand?
Yes, I do. So the electoral roll is sitting at about 17.1 million, which, I mean, it's always the highest, but that is the highest.
Yeah.
That represents about 96.5% of the eligible population, which, again, if you look internationally, it's remarkable. In terms of new people to the roll, the roll's grown by about 600,000. But that doesn't represent the new people, the new cohort, first-time voters, both youth and new citizens predominantly. It represents about 1.2 million because, of course, in between election cycles, you get people dropping off predominantly because they're deceased.
Right.
About 1.2 million first-time voters. So that's a lot of people who are new to the electoral system making their choice for the first time.
Yeah, and how long have they got from where we are now? We're at, you know, effectively day two of the election campaign, recording this on a Tuesday.
Monday the 18th of April at 8 p.m. local time, wherever you are around the country, that's the enrollment cutoff. That 1.2 million figure of other people.
So 1 week.
That's right. So that 1.2 million figure are the people who are already on the roll. If you look at youth, and it depends how you define it, but if you look at 18 to 24-year-olds, we estimate about 85% of that age cohort are on the roll. So that's a gap from the 96% more broadly. So there's a lot of young people who still need to get on the roll.
What's the rule with people who are about to be 18? Is there any leeway there if you're going to be 18? You know, within a certain period of time, or do you have to be 18 by polling day?
You've got to be 18 by polling day. So if you're turning 18 on the 21st of May, you can celebrate with a vote and a democracy sausage, but you'll have to be
even
enrolled.
A beer.
Well, that too, yeah. But you'll have to be enrolled by the close of roll. So if you're 16 or 17, you can always provisionally enroll.
Right. I suppose that's the way I should have framed the question, because that's the point, isn't it, really? If you're going to be 18, you need to make sure you're enrolled, and you can do that provisionally before you're 18.
Yes, that's right. And we have a number of people who do that in any case, not just on the doorstep to an election, but it's obviously particularly pertinent at the moment if people have a birthday coming up.
Right. Just another couple of quick questions. Early voting. There was a big issue at the last election because there was an extended period for pre-poll voting. I know the party's got quite antsy about it. I remember opining on this myself and sort of making the argument, which I think is pretty persuasive, which is that we're one of relatively few countries that has compulsory voting, which I fully support. But it seems to me the quid pro quo for that is that we ought to, if we're putting that obligation on people, a right and an obligation, that we should also make it as convenient as possible. But the parties, obviously, they want to campaign right to the end. They want to, they don't want to have half the, some significant slice of the electorate having cast votes before they even got around to unveiling, you know, perhaps their biggest advantage leading up to polling day. They're geared towards, most people voting on the day. It is a reduced period this time compared to last time, is it not, for pre-poll voting?
It is. It's a two-week pre-polling period. Last election, it was 3 weeks, and that's actually a result of legislative change that Parliament did in this electoral cycle. You talk about access to your vote and compulsory voting. Compulsory voting is probably one of the predominant things that contributes to the fact that we do have 96.5% of people on the roll, and 90% of those people, or I think it was just under 92%, who turned out at the last election, and hopefully it'll be higher this time. And we do go to significant effort that's not seen overseas. You know, our remote mobile polling program that we deliver in remote areas of Australia, the overseas services, residential care facilities, even Australians in Antarctica get their vote. So it's really a festival of democracy that we try and facilitate, and access is right up the top of that.
And a big challenge has been in some of those northern electorates, particularly in Northern Territory, where there is a deficit, if I can put it like that, of people who are eligible to be on the roll but who are not. Is extra effort going into getting those people on the roll?
Yeah, absolutely. The Northern Territory enrollment rate is a little bit lower, as is the national Indigenous enrollment rate. But we've seen growth in both of those areas over the last 5 years, which we hadn't seen previously, which is really pleasing. No one's going to be pleased until that gap is closed. But Indigenous enrolment nationally at the moment sits at around 80%. It's grown in the last 5 years since 2017 from 75%. So that's really pleasing, but we need it to get higher. So we've got about 70-odd partnerships that are in operation across Australia, and that's been leading up to the federal election to engage Indigenous Australians, educate them about the voting system, and boost enrolment, of course, because it's all about participating.
Yeah.
We think with that pivot to our partnership model that we did about 5 years ago, it's coincided with that growth. So we're pleased with that. But it's ultimately a generational issue that we're tackling here with Indigenous participation in the electoral system, and we can't do it alone. So we'll continue to endeavour to make good strides there and look to the broader community to help out, and not to mention Indigenous Australians themselves to jump on the roll and turn out and vote.
Terrific. Our final question, will there be any differences to counting on the night? I'm not suggesting that I know of any, but sometimes this has been the case where rural votes used to be counted, you know, early. I'm not sure whether that's always still the case. So sometimes those early counts wouldn't necessarily be representative. You'd be getting a lot more smaller booths in from some of those electorates that have rural and metropolitan or urban votes. Are there any of those kinds of differences that people watching the count on the night should keep an eye out for?
Not really. There's been some minor legislative change that allows us to start opening some envelopes earlier than 6 p.m., but it really is just allowing us to keep pace and unfold some of those unwieldy Senate ballot papers a little bit early. We don't count anything until 6 p.m. You will see those smaller regional polling places flow through first. We count everything that's cast on election day, on election night, and we also count the vast majority of pre-poll votes that night as well. Hopefully, we'll get an indication of who forms government off that. If we don't, people might have to wait a bit, and we'll start postal votes on the Sunday afternoon to give a bit of a trend there.
Yeah, terrific. Evan Eakin-Smith, thank you so much for being on Democracy Sausage. I think it's a really important service to be able to come on and talk about the logistics of our electoral process, which is something we should all defend and celebrate.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for defending and celebrating it with me.
That's encouraging. We'll go to a break and be back in a moment. We'll talk with Dr. Charlie Miller about Ukraine and other things. Cheers.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Charlie, we're going to talk about Ukraine. Before we do that, I probably should tell Democracy Sausages this bit of exciting news, at least the ones who are in the Canberra region, and that is that we've got a few things that we're sort of tossing around to really step up our engagement with the election itself. That was really useful, having that discussion about the logistics of the election. Some people might find it a bit dry, but it's really important to just know how the election's going to be run and what it means and when people need to be enrolled. And I hope that, you know, there might be some people who are listening. I guess people who are listening to Democracy Sausage are so enlightened they're already enrolled. But, but you know, they might be able to encourage someone they know that isn't enrolled to get on the roll. And, you know, voting's a, you know, it's a right. But, you know, compared to other countries, it's a great privilege too. So, if it gets people on the roll and thinking about how they can, you know, engage with the election and all that, that's a good thing. One of the things we're going to be doing that we're going to be doing next week, we hope, there's still a few, it's a bit of a TBC situation, but it looks like we're going to be able to do a live Democracy Sausage next week here on the ANU campus in Canberra, we hope. And that will be a really interesting event. Hopefully we'll get a good audience and we'll have a bit of fun as well as maybe even a shandy or two. and have a bit of fun talking about the election. I've got a couple of really top line names that I'm talking to make that happen.
Maria.
Maria Tafalaga, who's on most weeks, not here this week, unfortunately, but certainly Maria will be back and a couple of others that I'm not going to say now because I haven't confirmed with them yet. But I think anyone who listens to Democracy Sausage or takes an interest in Australian politics will be wanting to hear from these people as well. So if you're anywhere near Canberra and with the thing of doing this on Wednesday, the 20th of April, at about 6 p.m., I think is the time we're talking about. We will put out more details about this when we've nailed them down. But, if you're connected to ANU, but if you're in Canberra or the region and you can get along to it, it hopefully will be informative and fun entertainment as well. So there's that. Now, let's get to much more grim matters, and they are much more grim. We're talking about democracy and the fun of elections as well as the important issues that are there, but nothing fun or entertaining about Ukraine at the moment, is there?
Not at all.
This is an area that you have expertise in, strategic policy and defence and security issues as a political scientist, and it's a fascinating area. And you know, it's just terrible to think that the world order has broken down. We've got a P5 member, a member of the Permanent Five of the Security Council, engaging in a completely unlawful invasion of another country. This is not news, of course. It's been going on for a long time now, since 24th of February. And there was a long lead-up period, or at least it felt long at the time, lead-up period to it. Where are we with it now?
Well, where are we with it now? Look, the Ukrainians, I think it's fair to say, have won the Battle of Kiev, which is incredibly encouraging for anybody who supports democracy and believes in human rights and believes in the peaceful resolution of disputes. The Russian original maximalist aim of toppling the government and installing their own puppet government has failed. I don't think they're going to try that again. And I think we have to really give enormous credit to the Ukrainian government and to the Ukrainian armed forces and people for this victory. I think it's fantastic.
So Zelensky, Volodymyr Zelensky, who was struggling domestically as a president, has performed extraordinarily well in rallying his nation, but also in rallying the international community.
Yes.
I mean, he hasn't got sort of foreign forces in there, but he's got just about everything else.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot. I mean, an incredible level of support from other countries. I wouldn't say he's got just about everything other than foreign forces. There are still some things that he's not getting. There are still some countries that are dragging their feet. Cough, Germany, cough.
Well, that's interesting that you say that. So what is – I mean, Germany has – significantly changed as a result of this conflict. It's suddenly announced that it's doubling its defence budget. It'll probably go further than that, I imagine, now that it's broken away from that kind of long tail after the Second World War. It's pacifist stance, or it's, you know, it's essentially leaving defence to others. It's now going to be much more assertive in that regard. It sent funds and arms to...
Yes, it has. Yes, especially what's called the Panzerfaust anti-tank weapon. Actually, the same name as the same type of weapon that the Germans used to great effect during the Second World War. It's also called
against
Panzer,
the Russians.
Against the Russians and against the Western Allies as well. So they've sent them anti-tank weapons. They're dragging their feet a little bit about sending them actual tanks, however.
Right.
And also they're dragging their feet about bringing about a full-on embargo of Russian oil and gas. So, I mean, these are the two kind of things that Germany's dragging its feet on right now. With respect to Germany, so we've heard this before that, you know, Germany had this post-war kind of pacifist tradition about, you know, driven by their guilt about the war. In some ways, it's not quite true because Germany contributed very extensively to NATO and to NATO forces during the Cold War. They never obviously fought, but they were certainly prepared to fight. And they were a very important component of NATO's defense against the Soviet Union. After the end of the Cold War, you know, this is when, you know, people talk a lot about Germany's kind of pacifist tradition. But again, with the Kosovo War in 1999, this was the first time that Germany had actually participated in a war, in any kind of fighting at all since 1945. And this was seen as being some kind of a turning point driven by a revulsion at Milosevic's genocide of first the Bosnians and then later the Kosovar Albanians as well. So many people saw that as a turning point in German defense policy, but it turned out not to be. I think in part because over the course of the War on Terror, the Germans began to believe, I think with some justification, that events in Afghanistan or the Middle East were not directly relevant to German security. And they thought that they'd built up a good relationship with Russia based on trade such that they would not have to really pay serious attention to what was going on in Eastern Europe. And so they allowed a lot of the Bundeswehr, that is the German armed forces, capabilities to atrophy, especially its heavy capabilities like armor, aircraft, and so on. So whether this will actually result in a genuine long-term shift in towards Germany having a more heavily armed posture, actually not so much going back to what it was like prior to the Second World War, but actually going back more to the role that it played in the Cold War as being a major kind of bulwark of Western defense against Russia.
So it's not just about self-sufficiency because Germany's not going to be in a war on its own.
No, not at all.
But it's about contributing more assertively to NATO's defences and being more self-sufficient in its own defence.
Yes.
That responsible for holding its end of the log.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, Germany's really important for a number of reasons. So first of all, I mean, obviously the United States is also trying to cope with the rise of China. And ultimately the rise of China is a bigger long-term challenge to the United States than Russia. But the rise of Russia is a bigger long-term threat to Germany. Germany, absolutely, yeah. Right. So the hope amongst many American policymakers is that if Germany does more to balance against Russia in Europe, then the Americans can switch their attention to the Asia Pacific. And that's something that, so Elbridge Colby, who's an American strategist, who's written a very interesting book about how the United States should respond to the rise of China, wrote an op-ed in a German newspaper saying, look, Germany needs to do more in Europe because the United States can't. The United States has to focus on Asia and the Pacific.
It's really interesting, sorry to interrupt your flow there, but it's really interesting to think about how Trump used to complain about Europeans not paying for their own defense.
Yeah.
And, you know, really pointing the finger at Germany a few times. And I guess he had one thing, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, broken clock is right every year. Well, yeah, that's true. And I mean, the thing is that France already does quite a lot in terms of, so out of the EU's member states, it's the most militarily formidable. Britain does quite a lot as well. The smaller European countries, I mean, the problem is that collectively they might be able to do quite a lot. So if you put together the military capabilities of Denmark, Italy, Belgium, Czech Republic, and so on, it might come to quite a lot. But for each one of these countries individually, they have what you would call a collective action problem. So, you know, Denmark increases its military spending to like 3% of GDP, let's say. That's a big sacrifice for Danish policymakers who have to raise taxes or cut spending on something else. But in terms of how much it actually adds to the defense of Europe against Russia, it's not very much.
Sort of small, yeah.
Yeah, so all of these countries have big incentives to free ride on the bigger countries. And so therefore, what you have to really have in Europe is to have some big country that's going to step up and do the majority of the lifting. And that used to be the United States, but increasingly the United States can't do that anymore, which is why, you know, the rest of Europe is looking more to Germany to do that.
Yeah, and of course, as you say, France doing its bit, or at least doing a fair amount, and Germany's actually the largest economy in Europe, yes. Isn't it? So yeah, there's that expectation. The other thing that's been interesting in a sort of a geostrategic sense about all this is that those sort of neutral states have started talking about taking a much more positive defence posture.
Yes, yes. Finland's applying to join NATO, I understand.
Yeah.
And Sweden will quite likely apply to join NATO as well. So this is a pretty big deal. You know, Putin's worried about being encircled by NATO. And so he invades Ukraine, which has the consequence of him being even more encircled by NATO than he already was.
Yeah.
So it's quite a spectacular strategic blunder on his part.
Yeah. And yet he remains the holder of the largest nuclear arsenal. In terms of warheads, which is a concern, yeah.
It is a concern, yeah.
Because he's not fully sane.
Well, look, I actually had in a column in The Australian a few weeks ago, and I spoke on Sky News about this issue. There's all these kind of stories about Putin. There's sort of bizarre things, like the Daily Mail in Britain was reporting he'd been in this bizarre ritual where he'd sacrificed a wolf to some ancient Siberian god to see whether he was going to be healthy or not. And so I don't know how much to believe that kind of stuff. There's, you know, stories about how he's been increasingly isolated because of COVID. He's paranoid about getting COVID and so on. And all this kind of speculation, you know, like, has he changed? Is he going crazy and so on? I tell my students in foreign policy analysis that it's very difficult to make those kind of judgments from afar. First of all, because any leader's public persona is a careful strategic construction designed to portray the image that they want to portray. So in Putin's case, you know, he maybe wants Western countries to think that he's maybe a little bit irrational, might go a little bit too far, because that, you know, intimidates them and prevents them from helping Ukraine in ways that would harm Vladimir Putin. And also, I mean, it was an enormous strategic blunder that he made, but...
Because it was an enormous strategic blunder, that prima facie lends to the argument that he's not particularly rational, right?
Well, this is what I would dispute. So he made a mistake, but the point is, we know with the benefit of hindsight that it was a mistake. But if you look at it at the time, so before he was preparing the invasion, what would you have said? All right, how did the international community and how did the Ukrainians respond when he took Crimea and sent Russian forces into the Donbass? First of all, in 2014, when he did that, the Ukrainian army folded very easily. They scarcely fired a shot. So Putin got what he wanted. And, you know, the best, okay, like, past performance is not a certain guide to future performance, but it's not bad either. And so, you know, he had reasonable grounds to suspect that the Ukrainians would fold quite quickly. And if the Ukrainians had folded quite quickly, then, you know, what would the international response have been? It probably wouldn't have been as fierce as it has been. You know, there might have been some more sanctions, but you certainly wouldn't have seen, say, Germany taking the action that it's taken. You know, Putin had spent a long time, invested a lot of money building this kind of web of connections of, you know, party leaders that he had, you know, that he'd kind of cultivated, that sympathized with his worldview, and just politicians that he, you know, just through straightforward greed, just managed to pull into his sphere. You know, Gerhard Schroeder, the former Chancellor of Germany, was given a position on the board, I believe it was Rosneft, the Russian oil company, François Fillon, former French Prime Minister. You know, these he'd kind of brought these people in who he then thought could basically blunt the impact of any kind of backlash, you know, against Russian policy, and, you know, in the UK as well. All of these oligarchs, you know, Lord Lebedev and so on, who had donated to the Conservative Party, had close links with the Conservatives. You know, he thought that he could rely on this kind of network of influence to shield him against, you know, a Western European backlash against Ukraine, which he thought would fall anyway. And I mean, in advance, ex ante, I don't think that you can say this that it's irrational for him to think that that was all going to work. What he didn't reckon with was the resistance of the Ukrainians, the leadership of President Zelensky, which I think prevented the war from turning into a couple of days' walkover and allowed resistance to mobilize.
True. And look, I played guilty to that to some extent myself, because I remember writing that, the Ukrainians were going to be vastly outnumbered and, it was an asymmetric contest and so forth. So I certainly plead guilty in a sense to that. But there have been plenty of military adventures, that have happened in our lifetimes,
yeah,
that have just not gone anything like they should have in terms of the prejudgments on, mm-hmm. based on supposed strategic power, military strength. And Ukraine itself, of course, is the battleground where Napoleon, reached an impasse and was defeated.
Hitler as well.
Barbarossa with the Germans, and for some of the same reasons. I mean, the Russian tanks were forced onto narrow roads because they couldn't go across fields because the ice had thawed and the mm-hmm. fields had thawed and there was mud everywhere and so forth. I mean, these are sort of basic things that he must have known was likely to slow down his advance. He also seemed to attack on quite a number of fronts.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the plan in the end anyway, to occupy a country, as people keep saying, the size of France and with 44 million people, to occupy it sort of indefinitely?
Well, see, Putin thought that he wouldn't have to occupy it because he thought that he could basically
install a puppet government
who would have a lot more legitimacy amongst the Ukrainian people than would actually have been the case in reality, right? So that he seriously misjudged. In terms of sticking to the roads, from what I understand, the reason why they were sticking to the roads was so that they could get it done as quickly as possible. So they stick to the roads and they try and get into Kiev as fast as they possibly can.
But they did have those massive traffic jams.
Yes, they did, exactly. Yeah, that was incredible. Incredible logistical incompetence. I mean, I'm certainly not saying that his decision-making apparatus was very good. I don't think that he's irrational in the sense of being, I don't want to use kind of stigmatizing language, but quote unquote crazy. Mm. I think that there are serious problems with his decision-making apparatus in that people are not willing or able to tell him things he doesn't want to hear. I think that's a fair, I think that that's a fair critique. So if you look at the meeting, if you saw the pictures of that meeting that he had that was televised in Russia.
The one where the cabinet was about 20 or 30 meters away.
Right. Well, he was getting these guys to come up and he's getting the head of the FSB. So the guy who's organizing the poisonings worldwide coming up, and the guy's terrified and he's like stuttering and Putin's just bullying him. Mm. I mean, you look at that kind of environment and you think, is this the kind of environment in which somebody's going to say, actually, I think there are some problems with this operation. Plan. I don't think it is really. And you see this with a lot of dictators, they're not really willing to listen to people who tell them things that they don't want to hear. Yeah. You look at the decision making of Saddam during his wars, you look at the decision making of Hitler, Stalin.
No one wanted to give them bad news.
Yeah, no one wanted to give them bad news. Look at that scene in Downfall where they're trying to tell Hitler that, his counteroffensive has failed.
Yeah.
This is the problem that, senior generals and intelligence people have when they're in a dictatorship.
Yeah.
So I think that, yes, there were a lot of flaws in the operational plan, which if they'd had a really robust process where people were prepared to actually tell him things he didn't want to hear, that might have been flushed out.
Yeah.
But, that's different from saying that Putin himself is an irrational actor.
Yeah.
These are things that flow from the nature of the autocratic system that he was working in, I think.
But also he might end up being cornered into further irrationality, and that's actually a concern. One of the things going to this, all of these problems, what that flows from it presumably, is that he has now appointed a new military commander, because there was a sense, and this, I don't know whether you agree with this, but I saw some commentary that one of the reasons for all of these problems we've just been talking about is that they didn't really have proper centralized sort of military strategic overview of everything that they were doing. And he's now appointed this guy, Alexander Dvornikov.
Yep.
How significant?
Well, I mean, it is significant given Dvornikov's previous record. I mean, as long as that, I think it's either the butcher of Chechnya or the butcher of Syria, or perhaps the butcher of both.
Or the butcher of butcher.
The butcher of everywhere, really. I mean, he's... a terrible human rights record. But I mean, it seems like they didn't really need Dvornikov in order to grossly abuse people's human rights in the areas that they occupied. I don't think that having a single overarching commander is, or a lack of a single overarching commander or axis of advances, is exactly what's caused the Russians' problems. I think that the problems actually lie with the sort of the organization of their armed forces, the morale of their armed forces, ethnic divisions within the armed forces, some of their doctrinal problems. So the Soviet military was very top down, highly centralized, command and control type military. You did not do anything unless you got approval from the higher ups. You didn't do anything unless they got approval. So it was very, very slow and sluggish. Most analysts of modern warfare recognize that that's not a good way to fight under modern conditions. You have to give the lower echelons of the army, from privates all the way up, a significant degree of latitude to use their own initiative in order to fight well. And the Ukrainians have done this very well, but the Russians haven't. The Russians have really kind of struggled with
the only leeway they apparently give them is to abuse human rights.
Yes, yeah.
They did that in the Second World War as well.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It's been a sort of a feature of Russian armies for a long time.
It has. Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely.
To throw numbers at it. Mm-hmm. And to be utterly ruthless.
Yes, to be utterly ruthless, exactly. I mean, many of the stories are horrific stories that we're hearing coming from Ukraine. I heard some of them and I thought, you know, this can't be true. This must be some kind of propagandistic claim. But then I hear that, you know, they've actually been pretty well verified, a lot of them. And this is very similar to what the Russians did when they captured Berlin in the Second World War. But I mean, in terms of the actual deficiencies in their army, I think this top-down centralized command and control system, poor morale, especially ethnic divisions. The Russian army over-recruit from non-Russian ethnicities disproportionately, who are treated very badly in the Russian army, very badly in Russian society. They don't have very much of a desire to fight for Russia in the same way that ethnic Russians might. And so, you know, all of these problems are all kind of coming together. And faced with a Ukrainian military that's actually improved a lot since 2014, they're causing lots and lots of Russian setbacks. And so it may have helped them somewhat to have a more unified centralized command structure. But I don't think that's where the main problem lies.
And so now we see they're supposedly withdrawing to the east to be more concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean, and you started off saying that you think the Ukrainians have won the Battle of Kyiv, but does that mean it's all over? I see some reporting today from, I think, Chechenian sources saying that they still intend to move on targets around Kyiv.
That's possible, but I think what the Russians are doing now is they are attempting to make a move on the Donbass. So, I mean, if they were attempting to make
Mariupol, just to pulverize it.
Yeah, pulverize it. I mean, the idea is, so there's a salient, so basically a little kind of bulge of Ukrainian-held territory in the east of Ukraine, which contains a substantial proportion of the Ukrainian military. The goal of the Russians, perhaps, is to cut this off and then produce a kind of a mass surrender, or, you know, destruction,
sort of Stalingrad,
Stalingrad type operation. And this, I think, is what the Russians are moving to do. If the Russians were looking to move significantly on Kyiv again, I think it would be quite easy to spot. So, I mean, one thing we've seen in this war is the rise of OSINT, so open source intelligence. People can download satellite imagery and really high resolution satellite imagery for free or for very low cost, and they can look through and actually see where the Russian tanks actually are. So I don't think the Russians would be able to conceal it if they were actually trying to attack Kyiv again. It seems more like the Russians are moving their armor and concentrating in the Donbass.
Yeah, right. Now, we're getting close to time, so I want to just go to a couple of sort of domestic implications or domestic dimensions of this, Australia and France.
Mm.
I see that France has today, or in the last 24 hours, expelled some diplomats claiming they're spies, including, I think, the second in charge of the Russian embassy or mission in Paris. That's caught up, I suppose, in the French election. It has that domestic dimension to it, because I think Marine Le Pen, who Emmanuel Macron is now going to sort of race off against in the final choice for the French electorate, she seemed to be close to Putin,
mm-hmm.
or closer. Macron himself has kept dialogue with Putin going more than most other leaders. But that's an interesting development.
Yeah.
And, of course, Australia sending more bushmasters. We've been sort of progressively stepping up our involvement or our assistance to Ukraine as well. And that's, I guess, got a domestic implication with our election as well. You know, we hear reference to the Kharkiv election and so forth. Just your thoughts on those two.
Yeah, so those two things. Well, first of all, so I'm not really an expert in French politics. You maybe want to speak to, you know, Patrick Dumont, our colleague. Yeah. He'd be a good guy to speak to about this. But having spoken to him, I mean, Marine Le Pen is a real worry because the French polls for the second round are pretty much neck and neck. I'm not sure how reliable they are as well. There's evidence that the pollsters are herding. That is that they're not kind of producing independent information, but trying to stick around the mean. So there is a very real chance that Marine Le Pen could win. And if she does, that's a big, big problem for the Western effort against Russia.
France, I would imagine.
For France, absolutely. For ethnic minorities in France, it's
and
terrible.
For European and leadership, for Europe, actually, because, I mean, Macron has really inherited Merkel's mantle as, you know, the sort of dominant.
I mean, it's a terrible thing to contemplate, but I mean, you know, there's a pretty substantial chance that it would happen. We're looking at, you know, sort of Brexit Trump type territory.
Yeah.
And, you know, Zemmour, who's even more extreme than Le Pen, has dropped out.
He's been knocked out.
Told his supporters to vote for Le Pen. But Mélenchon on the left, there's a substantial proportion of his supporters who probably will not vote at all and are not going to give their votes to Emmanuel Macron.
Shades of Bernie Sanders is a supporter.
Even more so, most of the Bernie people did come round to Hillary in the end.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, Mélenchon, it might be an even bigger issue. So that's definitely one to watch. I'm quite concerned about it, to be honest. Now, Macron has produced posters showing, you know, like a split poster with, you know, Marine Le Pen's face on the one side, Vladimir Putin's on the other. The issue of Ukraine is at all salient to the French public, then, you know, he could really just hammer home that message that voting for Le Pen is voting for Putin. Mm. But having said that, it's a very similar problem to what the Democrats had in the United States with Trump. If they hammer on Russia, 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 then that may seem to some voters like they're ignoring domestic concerns.
Sort of like an elite concern rather than the cost of living
Exactly. So, I mean, I don't know enough about French politics to see how productive that strategy would be for Emmanuel Macron. So I don't know. I know that, you know, French opinion is generally in favor of Ukraine. I've seen there's lots of French people volunteering to fight in the Ukrainian military and to give charitable donations and so on. But I mean, you know, to what extent that's actually going to move people's votes in the presidential election, I don't know. Probably have to speak to Patrick Dumont about that.
Yeah.
In terms of Australia here, I mean, I think it just underlines to the rest of the world, you know, that we thought that big, great power conventional warfare was a thing of the past and we didn't have to worry about it anymore. Yeah. You know, like we'd had a long period of peace in the world. And Bear Braunmuller, who's an American political scientist, he's looked at the data about great power wars. And he says, look, let's assume that you have a big, huge world war every 100 years or so, right? That's the kind of baseline risk. Well, we've gone for like 70 years without the last one. Is that a long enough period to conclude that this sort of baseline one every 100 years risk has changed? Not. You know, it's as if, like, you know, a bus comes along every 50 minutes and we're at the 40 minute mark and we think the buses aren't coming anymore. We wouldn't think that. So, you know, it's a real concern. Great power war could very well be on the way back. And if that's the case, then, you know, that has really important implications about, you know, how Australia's policies in a lot of areas, you know, how we structure the ADF, how much we spend on defense, but other things too. But what are our trading relations like? You know, do we continue to be so heavily dependent on trade with China? Do we continue to be so heavily dependent on fossil fuels? Do we try and move towards, you know, the sort of renewable sources of energy that we can actually, you know, source right here in Australia? So I think there's big conversations that need to be had.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And look, frankly, we could talk about this for a long time. We could talk about some of these issues in a subsequent episode of Democracy Sausage. Perhaps we'll do it after after the election. Maybe we'll get to it before. I don't know. But, look, there's so much to talk about here. And thanks so much, Charles, for spending some time with us today, being back on Democracy Sausage.
Yeah, thank you for having me back.
And that's it for the program for this week. As I said just at the start of the half, we are hoping to have a live episode next week. If you're in Canberra, you can get along to that. I think you'll really enjoy it. I'm hoping that it will be a lot of fun as well as informative. And watch the podcast being recorded. Until then, bye for now.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.